I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. She's been on the front lines amidst gunfire, seen human cruelty at its worst, and even been kidnapped twice. So why does she keep going back? Today, wartime photojournalist Lindsay Addario discusses her career covering conflicts in Africa and the Middle East. Find out why she believes the risks are worth the results. Then, delivering the perfect pitch is more than just a skill, it's a science. We'll review the history behind baseball's most crucial skill. From slider to fastball and more, learn how pitching is evolving. Later, this week's installment of Statehouse Blend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. To say that Lindsay Addario has paid a price for what she does is hardly a stretch. She's been kidnapped, ambushed, and injured. She's been in car accidents and faced death threats, all in the name of her work as a wartime photographer in far distant locations such as Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, and the Congo. It's that single-minded pursuit of the truth that can so vividly be represented in photographs that earned her a Pulitzer Prize for covering conflicts in Africa and the Middle East. Now her memoir, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, has been optioned by Warner Brothers, with Steven Spielberg attached as the director, and the world's highest-paid actress, Jennifer Lawrence, signed to play her. Lindsay Addario speaks in town tonight at the Kauffman Center. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She's the winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant, and she was last on this show in 2015. And welcome back. So good to have you, Lindsay.
Thank you for having me.
You know, why not simplify your life and work as a newspaper photographer in a major American city? Why risk it the way you do?
I never really thought about it. For me, it was always about telling these stories and getting out there. So often I would be interested in a story and I felt like there were women who were facing these injustices and humanitarian issues. And before I knew it, I was in the middle of it. And so I wasn't really thinking about my own safety. I was thinking about, you know, the story that I was telling. And often I feel like if the people that I'm covering are there risking their lives, and they're often women and children and civilians, then why can't I be there?
So you're in the middle of gunfight and you're not thinking about gunfire. You're not thinking about what you should be. You should be somewhere else.
Okay, so gunfire is a different thing. Obviously, when I'm with the military or if I'm on the front line and I'm being shot at, the first thing I'm thinking is, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think obviously no one likes to be shot at. But of course, I know the answer to that. I think it's important to cover these issues, and particularly when we have troops and we have troops in combat.
And it's the title of your memoir, It's What I Do.
It is.
It's what you do.
It is what I do.
How did you wind up covering war for a career?
I first started covering Afghanistan under the Taliban. So it was before September 11th, and I had heard about the situation of women living under the Taliban. And I was curious. I was 25 years old. I felt invincible. I thought, are these women really leading such horrific lives, or is it really just a projection of American values on women in Afghanistan? And so I wanted to answer that question, and so I went there, and I started interviewing and photographing women myself. And so that was sort of my first experience of being in a hostile country. There wasn't a battle going on around me. It wasn't until I started covering the war in Iraq where I first was under fire.
Do you still feel invincible?
No. I think that's something that comes with age. One no longer feels invincible. I'm 43. I have been kidnapped twice. I've been in a car accident where my driver died. I've probably said my final prayers three or four times. So, yeah.
You know, your son was born in 2011. That same year, you and three colleagues from the New York Times were taken captive in Libya. You're referring to that just a minute ago. And you were all held for several days. I want to read an excerpt of a story you wrote for the Times, and it was titled, "What Can a Pregnant Photojournalist Cover?" everything was the answer. This is what you write about the day you were taken. I pressed my face into the soil, sucking in a mouthful of fine sand as a soldier pulled my hands behind my back and kicked open my legs. I raised my eyes from the ground and looked directly into the soldier's eyes. The only thing I could think to do was plead, but my mouth was so dry, as if my saliva had been replaced with dirt, I could hardly utter a word. "Please," I whispered, "please. Will I see my parents again? Will I see my husband? How could I do this to them? Will I get my cameras back? How did I get to this place?" What happened next?
God, it's hard to hear that. What happened next? I pleaded for some time, for what seemed like an eternity. And we were very lucky. The commander, we each had a gun put to our heads, and we were each staring down the barrel of a gun and begging for our lives. And at that moment, a commander walked over and said, "You can't kill them. They're American." And Anthony Shadid, who spoke Arabic and
of the Times,
of the New
York
Times,
Pulitzer Prize winning,
he was next to me, and he later translated that for us. That's what happened. That's what ultimately stopped them from shooting us. Is that the commander came over and said, "You can't kill them. They're American." So they didn't shoot us at that point, but they tied us up, blindfolded us, beat us repeatedly over the course of 6 days. Actually, the first 3 days were the most brutal, and threatened us with execution over and over.
What was that like for you?
You know, I think the thing that a lot of people don't understand, and I think it's hard for me to even conceive of how I lived through that, is the survival instinct of a human being. And so I think in that moment, I'm not looking at the bigger picture. I am literally getting through each second. And it's basically, how can I stay alive? How can I manage this fear and this sort of, how do I just get through each moment?
Lindsay Addario is my guest, the famed photojournalist. I'm going to go backwards here in a moment. Your group was in a car approaching a checkpoint, and you were urging the driver to blow past the checkpoint to get away from the situation you found yourself in. Why were you urging the driver to blow right through it?
So first of all, I think we were four journalists in the car at that point, and we were all screaming something different. I don't think I was screaming anything, actually. I was sort of observing, because I had this premonition that that was going to happen, actually.
That if you stopped, all heck would break loose.
No, I had a premonition we would be overrun and be taken by Gaddafi's troops. And I had it so strongly that actually about 48 hours before it happened, I handed a hard drive of all my photographs to Brian Denton, who was leaving the front line. He was a photographer for a colleague of mine. And I said, if something happens to us, make sure that at least my pictures survive. So I kind of had a premonition that we would be taken at some point. So when I actually saw Gaddafi's troops on the horizon, I kind of knew that we were about to hit this checkpoint. And so Tyler was screaming, "Don't stop, don't stop." And I don't remember what Steve and Anthony were screaming, but everyone was screaming something different. And our driver panicked and stopped and decided it would be safer to say, "We're journalists, please don't kill us." Because if you blow past a checkpoint, obviously the risk is that they just open fire on you and shoot you.
Of course.
So we really didn't know the best tactic. Of course, when you stop, you also expose yourself to what we did ultimately, and that's being taken captive or being thrown in jail. Or being beaten and threatened with execution. And our driver died. And we don't know if he was executed in that moment. We don't know if he was put in prison and died. We don't know if he died in crossfire. But no one ever saw him again after that moment when our car was stopped.
So for you, the work is worth it. The images are worth it. Is that where you are?
So I think every story and every situation is different. I think it's not fair to make sort of a blanket statement, because I go into each assignment weighing the risk and deciding how far forward I want to go and how much material I need to tell that story.
This is 2011. You're 500 miles from Tripoli. You're in the middle of the Libyan desert. There's no safety net there at all.
No,
you are on your own.
Yeah, I mean, that was the hardest part about it. Libya was probably the toughest conflict I've ever covered, and I've covered conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Lebanon, Congo, Darfur, South Sudan. I've covered a lot of conflict. And Libya, to me, was the worst because it's flat terrain. There's nowhere to hide. There's no cover. We were not with American troops. We were with Libyan fighters who were basically just decided to uprise against their government and had no fighting training. This is very early on in the revolution. So, you know, it was terrifying. You know, the combat was terrifying. We had sniper fire, tank fire, mortar rounds. Gaddafi had an air force. He would come in and swoop down over us and literally spray the ground around us with 50 caliber bullets, and there was nowhere to hide.
With that particular assignment, why did you go, given what you're saying here?
Because I felt like I had covered, at that point, the Muslim world, the Middle East, South Asia, Africa for a decade, and I had been covering a lot of combat. No one knew Libya would turn out the way it did. Everyone thought Libya would be like Egypt and a popular uprising with no violence, essentially. So we all went in there thinking, oh, we're going to document the fall of Gaddafi. It's such an important historical time. It's so important for journalists to be there. And then we ended up in the middle of combat.
You know, I've known war correspondents, known a bunch of them, given the fact that I've been a journalist in my career, too. A lot of you guys are adrenaline junkies.
I knew that was coming.
You're nodding your head.
I'm not in my head. I mean, I have to say, of course, adrenaline is involved. Of course, when I'm out with the troops in the middle of a base in Afghanistan for 2 months, it's, you know, you're surviving on adrenaline because you're not sleeping, you're not eating properly, and it's the thrill of being there and documenting history and documenting what no one else essentially in the world can see. You know, we are sort of the mirror for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But that said, it's not what brings me to cover a war.
And what it is...
What is it is that I think we need to have a document of history. We need to show policymakers what's happening. We need to show them the results of their foreign policy. We need to see the human rights abuses, how women are being killed for trying to divorce a man in certain countries. How, you know, this to me, it is essential for all of us to be at least aware of what happens around the world.
Well, that's why you won the Pulitzer Prize.
I mean, look, it was a group Pulitzer. It was with a team of New York Times journalists, brilliant New York Times journalists it was the Afghanistan-Pakistan package in 2009. I think it was a team effort.
What's the worst jam you've ever been in?
Libya, I think was.
Was that it, that moment?
I mean, it was 6 days. So it was, you know, the thing that, is the thing about being kidnapped is, it seems so obvious, but you have absolutely no power. There's no, you can't fight your way out of it. You can't convince someone. You can't scream and shout. You just close your mouth and do what you're told and hope that it doesn't get worse.
So how did you cope through those 6 days? Were you all kept together? Did you have each other to lean on a little bit?
I mean, I think that was, we were so lucky that they kept us together. That to me is what really got us through. And we were all people, we all knew each other and we all had that common experience of having worked in hostile situations for many, many years. And so I think we all understood sort of the unspoken terms to not freak out, not scream and shout, to just do what we were told. And I think that essentially is what kept us alive.
Does that come easily to you? Did you want to scream and shout?
I did not.
I'm going to raise my hand here.
No.
I might have.
I didn't. You know, it goes.
That's why I covered Topeka and Jefferson City, Lindsay. It's a whole different kind of thing for me. Yeah.
It goes back again to that survival instinct. And I go into like a very sort of Zen state where I just sort of shut down emotionally and just really kind of just stay focused.
I should point out that Lindsay will be speaking this evening at 7:30 tonight at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Her topic is the same title as her book. It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. I gather you'll be showing photographs, some of your work there tonight, Lindsay?
I will. I'll be showing a lot of photos. I'll be telling the stories behind the photos. I'll talk about Libya. I'll talk about covering the war in Iraq, Afghanistan. There's some maternal health work in there, some women's issues.
Yeah. And just for the record, I admire what you guys do so much. Just know that. More information about her talk is at coffincenter.org. You know, you write in your book, in your memoir, that many times the struggle for you isn't about going into a dangerous situation. It's why you can't be in two dangerous situations at once. What do you mean by that?
You know, for me, it's a struggle that I have basically every day of my life. I want to be covering so many stories, and I can't be in two places at once. And I'm constantly juggling which story I could tell most effectively, what I want to cover.
And that's got to be a hard set of decisions to make when you're doing something like that.
Well, it is, and particularly now because I have a child, and so I actually also have to go home, and that's something I never had to do before. I mean, I used to live on the road, and so now I have that pressure and that need to go home.
Hey, has marriage and has family changed what you're willing to do?
I mean, no offense to my husband. I love him. I have a great husband. But marriage didn't really change that because, you know, he's a partner. He's my husband. He's wonderful.
He knew what he was getting into.
Yeah, and he was a journalist. So
how about your son?
It's changed. I mean, yeah. I feel like I have to stay alive, and that's something that I never really I sort of accepted death as a possible consequence of this work before.
You have spent time in South Sudan, where war has actually separated families. There was one mother and son you were able to help. Tell us about that.
So this is sort of, to me, one of the stories that has moved me the most in my career. And I met a young boy named Chol. I was covering the Displaced series for the New York Times Magazine. There were three children who were displaced by war. Chol was on the run in South Sudan. His village had been attacked in the middle of the night. And his father was put in a tukul, a straw house there, and set on fire and burned to death. He fled with his grandmother and was separated from his mother. And his mother and other, I think, eight siblings lived in the bush. And so they had no means of communication. When I met Chol, he was on the run to Kenya to try to get to safety. And I spent 5 days with him in a swamp, literally on a small island, documenting his journey. And about 6 months later, I was sent on assignment with Time magazine back to the area where I knew his mother was from, and I decided to try and find her. And of course, I only knew her name and her village name. I knew nothing. I thought I would never find this woman. There are no phones, nothing. But a local NGO through ICRC helped me find her, and I found her. I brought her a picture of her son. I brought her the New York Times magazine. And she had no idea he was even alive. And she asked me to record a video message of that I could then bring to her son. And she literally says to him, please stay in Kenya. Don't come home because you're now the man of the family, the oldest boy at 12 years old. Mm. Stay there, get education, study, and come home once you've learned. And I brought that to him. I then went to Kenya and found him again, brought it to him, and he saw his mother and he said, I have to study. And it was like he was so empowered by her words. And just the fact that it was the first time in my career I could actually bring together a family through images and video and just through my own sort of making the effort to go back and find these people.
So when you're in the swamp and you're on the island, you know, and you're shooting a subject for a newspaper or a magazine, what about lunch and dinner and breakfast and stuff? I mean, how does that work?
You fly your own food in. So I brought protein bars. I brought Starbucks via packets. I brought I bring drink mix, protein powder. You just don't really eat. Food is sort of just energy in that week. You know, it's a week of my life. It's not, I don't care about that stuff. You know, to me, it's coffee is the one thing I cannot do without. I'm sort of obsessive
We got to get real here, right?
Yeah.
Acres has called us to ask what kind of camera you use.
I'm a lifelong Nikon shooter. I'm a Nikon ambassador. I have a Nikon 810 and a D5.
So I've got to ask. This movie is being made. You know, this names being attached to it are Spielberg and Lawrence. Is this thing really going to happen?
You know, I'm not a Hollywood person. I've spent a lot of time with Jennifer Lawrence.
Your new friend Jen. Yeah.
She's Jennifer Lawrence. She's hilarious and smart and great and very dedicated and an incredible actress. So, of course, I think, she's obviously making the effort to spend time together. So it's
she's interviewing you about your life and your work and how you do what you do.
She's interviewing me. She came on assignment with me. I brought her to the border of South Sudan and Uganda.
Really?
Like that was a tough trip, and she did it. She wanted to do it.
Did she get cranky?
She did not. She was a trooper. She was hardcore. I mean, I'm tough when I work. I'm up at 5. I'm out the door. It's protein bars and water, you know, and she was great. She was amazing.
And Steven Spielberg.
Yep.
Guy to have leading your
church. No, not at all. So I think Steven is amazing and the script is written. So that was sort of the hardest part, is just actually adapting the book to a 2-hour movie.
Were you involved in the script at all?
So Peter Craig is the writer. He is incredible. He also came on assignment with me. I've spent a lot of time with him. And I look at drafts. I don't have veto power, but I'm certainly involved in the consultation.
Are you happy with it?
Yeah, you know, it's my life, so it's a bit weird.
How weird is this? This is really weird, isn't it?
It's strange, but, you know, I think the deal with selecting a team of creative people is that I trust their integrity. So I think for me it was like I don't have delusions that this is going to be a documentary or nonfiction. There are things that will be fictionalized. That is just something that's a reality in Hollywood and in any movie. So, you know, for me, it was about going with a team that I trust and respect.
I got to ask you one more thing before I lose you here, because you're just so interesting. You once said that as a woman, that you can move around under the radar in so many of the places where you wind up. You also said this, Lindsay, one great advantage of being a female journalist is that people often don't know how to respond to me. I think in many of the countries that are more conservative, I am sort of this weird third gender, this sexless person. I can mix with the men, but I can also mix with the women, and that's unique. So is it an advantage being a woman?
I think so. I think it's a great advantage. I think, you know, also as things become more dangerous for journalists, I can put on an abaya and a headscarf and look like a local woman. And I think
– And you've done that.
Oh, I do it all the time. And I think it's really enables me the liberty of movement that is very difficult now.
Now, I mentioned before the show, if you need someone to play your husband in the film, I think I'd be great. I think I'm perfect for it.
I'll pass that on.
Pass that on, please. Lindsay Addario will be speaking tonight at 7:30, the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Her topic, it's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. It'll be fascinating. More information, kauffmancenter.org. What a pleasure to have you here. Safe travels. Wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the art of throwing a baseball. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we heard stories about the White House from press corps member Paul Brandis. Also, we found out how extreme weather shifts affect our drinking water. Those conversations are online at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Burns & McDonald's new proposal to design, build, and finance a one-terminal KCI. That's very much in the news. That's tomorrow's topic here on Up to Date. Fooling the hitter, that's what the art of pitching is all about. Raw deception, placing the ball where the hitter doesn't expect it, or throwing it in such a way that the pitch is utterly unpredictable. It drops instead of racing across home plate in a straight line, or it curves and the hitter is fooled again. Terry McDermott has written an ode to pitching. It's titled Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. It's built around a pleasant memory for a Seattle Mariners fan, as Terry is, the perfect game that Mariners pitcher Felix Hernandez threw on August 15th, 2012. Terry McDermott is a former national reporter for the Los Angeles Times and the author of 3 previous books, including The Hunt for KSM, Inside the Pursuit and Takedown of the Real 9/11 Mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He joins us by Skype. And Terry, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
What was that Felix Hernandez perfect game like for a devout fan of the Seattle Mariners?
Well, it was, you know, a ray of light in an otherwise bleak existence. the Mariners have been a pretty bad team for most of the time they've been around. So, you take it where you can get it, I guess, right?
Yeah.
It's like the Royals for so long, right? They weren't that good for, there was like a 30-year period in there where they were bad, but then, look what happened. So part of being a baseball fan, I think, is just you have to be patient. It's not a fast game.
What made Felix Hernandez so unhittable on that day in August of 2012?
Well, Felix is blessed with unusual flexibility in his wrists and hands. He can almost throw any pitch he wants. The question, as ever with him, is if he knows where it's going to go. So the days that he has really good control, he's almost unhittable. I mean, it's not unusual for him. His ball moves so much. I mean, he throws changeups that break 3 feet. You
Wow.
know, his two-seam fastball breaks the same amount in the other direction. It's just ridiculous. And he throws everything from the same release point, so hitters can't tell. You know, a hitter has 4/10 of a second to hit. That's how long it takes for the ball to leave the hand and cross the plate. Hitter has to decide in half of that time, 2/10 of a second, whether or not to swing and where. That's how long it takes to blink your eyes twice. Think of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You talk a lot in here, Terry, about the need for deception on the pitcher's part. And I was surprised to read some of that, I guess, on one level, because, you write in here that the pitcher starts with all kinds of advantages. And for one thing, he stands on a little hill. For another, he's only 60 feet away, and then he takes up 10% of that space with his windup and release of the ball itself. So how much of an edge does a pitcher wind up having here?
Well, think about it. I mean, the most successful hitters in the history of Major League Baseball hit, you make outs 2/3 of the time, at least. So a pitcher from the very start of the game is all he's. It's weird that he's considered on the defense, right? That the team in the field is defensive because the pitcher is really the offense. He starts the action. And he can throw the ball almost anywhere he wants. And he can make it move in almost any direction. And the hitter's just standing there with a piece of, round wood. And he has to swing that thing in 2/10 of a second. And there's only about a 5-square-inch area on the bat where if you hit the ball anywhere else, it's not going to go anywhere. So he's swinging, a yard-long piece of round wood with a 5-square-inch area he has to apply to a ball that's moving 90 miles an hour and moving in unknown directions. Think about that, right?
Yeah. Well, you conclude by saying this, Terry, the deck, in other words, is stacked, and it's stacked in
Yeah.
favor of the pitcher, obviously, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And pitchers keep coming up with new pitches. I mean, that's part of the story of the book too, is the history of pitching and how it's changed. Every decade or so, a new pitch comes along and everybody's throwing it, and then it just disappears and they're on to something else.
Like, what's the latest new pitch that you've come across?
Well, I think the most there's two pitches that are thrown a lot today that weren't thrown much before. One is the cut fastball, which is a fastball that moves almost as fast as the fastest pitch, but moves a small amount, about 4 or 5 inches, but right at the end of its journey to the plate. And so it looks like a straight pitch until it gets there, and then it moves. I mean, Mariano Rivera was famous. I mean, he made his career throwing that one pitch. That and the changeup has come back again. I mean, it's never gone. Originally pitchers couldn't throw fast. They weren't allowed to by the rules. They threw underhanded and slow.
Yes.
And batters could ask for the pitch to be delivered in a specific spot. That's changed, obviously. So the circle changeup, which is a way a changeup is thrown today, is another really popular pitch now that wasn't around for a long time.
So what else can a pitcher do to increase his deceptiveness?
Well, he can control where he throws the ball from, the release point, it's called. Some pitchers, move their arm all over the place, and so a certain kind of pitch will be thrown from a certain angle. Other pitchers, like Fernandez, throws almost every pitch from exactly the same spot, so it's further. I mean, you don't know when the ball is coming out of the pitcher's hand what it's going to be. Hitters are smart. I mean, they study pitchers, and they some hitters are astonishing that they can tell within 2 feet of the ball's arc what it's going to be, where it's going to be. I mean, I have no idea how the brain does that. It's an extraordinary feat of computation.
Is there one tactic or two that is universally regarded as the most beneficial to a pitcher?
Well, that's the thing. As deceptive as they can be, look, you and I can sit there at a ball game, and the pitcher will throw a fastball in the inside corner, and then he'll throw a fastball in the outside corner, and we're sitting there going, he's going to throw a breaking ball low and away right now. And if we know that, obviously the hitter knows it too, and he does that, and the hitter's brain won't allow him to see it. it's still seeing the prior two pitches.
Which pitch is generally regarded as the toughest to hit? I is there one?
110 mile an hour fastball.
Don't make this complicated, right?
No, I mean, look, as they say in the game, a located fastball is the best pitch. The speed matters less than the ability to throw it exactly where you want to. One of the greatest pitchers of recent times, Greg Maddux, longtime Atlanta Brave, basically threw one pitch. He threw a cut fastball. That was it. And he didn't throw hard. He barely broke 90 for most of his career, but he was unhittable because he threw the ball exactly where he wanted to throw it.
A cut fastball means what, Terry?
It means it moves from a right-hander, it moves about 4 or 5 inches to his left as it crosses the plate. It's just enough to get from the middle of the bat to the end of the bat. Or if he's throwing it to a left-handed hitter, it moves in on his hands. There's a reason Mariano Rivera threw that same pitch. And one of the going away gifts he got from other teams was a rocking chair made out of broken bats. For a
Because
reason.
that's
He broke a lot of bats.
he broke a lot of bats. Terry McDermott's my guest. His new book, Off Speed: Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception. What's the difference between a four-seam fastball and a two-seam fastball?
Four-seamer will appear to rise as it comes to the plate. No pitch actually rises. They all fall. Gravity's unbeaten, as far as I can tell. And a two-seam fastball is a kind of sinker. So it drops more than you would anticipate. The point of making pitches rise or fall or seem to is so that the ball does arrive at a place different from where the hitter's brain is telling him it's going to. I interviewed hitters for this book too, and one of them told me that, look, it's not like I want to swing at balls in the dirt. I'm not trying to do that. They do it because they're fooled. They think it's one kind of pitch when it's another.
And what's the difference between a curveball and a slider? Because even after years of watching baseball, I gotta admit, I still get confused.
Curveball moves more. It moves more vertically. It drops. I mean, a classic curveball, an overhand curveball, as you used to call it, would go from noon to 6 o'clock. Drop straight down. A slider moves more horizontally, from right hand or from right to left, and it's thrown a little bit faster. I mean, some curveballs are really slow. I mean, they're like 80 miles an hour, and some fastballs are 85, 89, something like that. So there's a difference in speed.
What's an ephus? Am I saying that right?
That's right. An ephus is a weird, it's a lob, basically. It's like, you ever seen a slow pitch softball game? That's what an ephus is. It's one of those. And if you've ever played slow pitch softball, I mean, you feel like a fool
It's
if you're
really
swinging
hard.
this,
It's really
right?
hard.
Yeah, it's harder than it looks. So that's what an ephus is. And the weird thing, some of the most effective pitches, I mean, I think probably the hardest pitch to hit other than a 110 mile an hour fastball is a knuckleball, because not even the pitcher knows where it's going. And so you're up there throwing a ball and it breaks. You don't even know what direction it's going to break, move. And sometimes it breaks more than once. And nobody can hit it. I mean, Bob Uecker, the broadcaster and ex-catcher, said the best way to catch a knuckleball pitcher is wait for the ball to hit the backstop and walk back and pick it up. But baseball managers hate knuckleball pitchers because it's not dependable, and they think it's somehow, it's a thing. It's a sport played by men, and they're very manly men. They hate it when pitchers don't throw them fastballs. He's acting like a sissy out there. You know, they go back to the bench after they strike out on a changeup. They'll go, throw it like a man.
Well, does anybody throw this Ephus pitch anymore where it goes 20 or 25 feet up in the air, then drop straight down over home plate?
Nope, he's thrown it for a while. The last guy was a left-handed pitcher for the Yankees, Steve Hamilton. That was, 40 years ago. Oh. Once a decade, somebody will throw one, you know?
Yeah.
I think more for entertainment purposes than anything.
Well, speaking of entertainment purposes, pitches that have disappeared, you define the spitball in your glossary as, you know, an illegal pitch where you apply a foreign substance to the ball like saliva or Vaseline. When I was a kid, I was fascinated by all these accusations that Gaylord Perry was throwing spitballs. The umpires would stop the game and go out to the mound and check him out, and it seemed like they never caught him red-handed, but I think, didn't they finally catch him once?
They caught him more than once.
Yeah.
I mean, he was late. He wrote a book while he was still playing, like Me and the Spitter.
Yeah.
and then after that, he would say, well, I used to throw it, but I don't anymore. It doesn't matter if I don't, because the hitters all think I do. So you're in their head from the beginning. I think it's still thrown with some regularity.
But you never hear anybody talking about it anymore. You never see games get stopped and someone, their umpire, rush out to check the pitcher.
You're right. Not in the last few years, but you know there'll be a pitcher who has suspicious amounts of movement on the ball, and hitters will start complaining about it and ask for the ball to be checked. But it comes and goes. Pitching styles change over time, but there's really nothing new. You know, pitches disappear, then they come back, and I'm sure the spitter will come back in great popularity.
Terry, I got 30 seconds left. Do you have a pick for the all-time greatest pitcher?
Oh, all-time greatest. Well, for 5 years, it was Koufax. Mm-hmm. I mean, other than that, Cy Young won 500 games. Come on.
Terry McDermott's new book, Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. Terry, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
It's time now for State House Blend Missouri. The 2017 Missouri regular legislative session ended on Friday with a whole lot of tension and a few results. I joined host Brian Ellison, KCUR's news director Maria Carter, and Brian Howsworth from MissouriNet to explore the session's most significant outcomes, its biggest political stories, and, as Howsworth says, one explosive final day.
I've never seen anything like it. It was bizarre. It was tense. It was crazy. Every type of adjective you can think of. The tension. And I was in the House. I had two other reporters in the Senate, and they were telling me that there was screaming going on over there in the Senate. Literally, Rob Schaff's microphone was cut off, but he continued to scream. And in the House, I think one instance really sums up, guys, what kind of really took place yesterday, and that is when Mike Searpoy, the House Majority Floor Leader from Lee's Summit, he wanted to cut off debate. He called the previous question on the issue about the health care. The Democrats had about 20 members on the floor that were trying to be recognized, and Searpoy called for the previous question. And Representative Deb Lavender, who is from Kirkwood, mild manner, she's progressive on health care. She wasn't hit a microphone, but she literally started screaming on the floor, "How dare you do this? How dare you do this? The Senate is dysfunctional." They gaveled her down. She continued to scream, and she was talking about the people that were going to lose their health care. She appeared to me, and I tweeted it. You guys saw my tweet. She appeared to me to start crying on the floor, put her head down, threw her papers on the floor, and stormed out. Now, she tweeted at me that she wasn't crying, that she was passionate, but I've never seen her that fired up. What really kind of is interesting is, as heated as that was, at the very end, just out of nowhere, the House decided to allow a vote, and in many ways, the Democrats got a victory out of that because they got really what they wanted, but it took all the way till the end, and it surprised everyone. I've never seen anything like it.
You know, you just wonder, you know, this kind of vitriol in the Missouri General Assembly, the question in my mind, Brian, is what this portends for the future here. If you have the Senate at near meltdown status week after week of this session, what this means for the special sessions going forward, if there are special sessions this year, the next year, boy, it doesn't bode well.
Let's move on to talk about the session as a whole, not just the last day or the last week, but some of the highs, the lows, the things that were done and the things that were left undone. Starting with kind of the most significant legislative achievement or action in your mind. Doesn't have to mean you think it's the best one, but the most significant. Let's go around the table. Maria Carter.
I'm going to say right to work. This is something, you know, Republicans have been pushing for. I looked it up. There was a constitutional amendment on the ballot before I was born in 1978, you know,
wow.
And so,
wow.
I mean, this has been going on. And I was just thinking about, you know, how, you know, Republicans have gotten pretty far with right to work bills. You know, now they had the supermajority and Greitens was a very big proponent of this. And so, you know, they got that passed early and done. And I think that was, you know, one of their major successes.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the sort of the package of pro-business reforms, and I don't want to take everyone's answers by lumping them all into that one, but between the tort reform, between the employment laws that were approved, making it much harder to prove employment discrimination, all in all, if you had to point to something out of Governor Greitens' legislative agenda that was not an unmitigated success, but a clear win, right to work and the surrounding pro-business, anti-labor laws seem to me like the obvious.
You know, the line you heard several times yesterday was, Missouri is open for business again. That's a cliched response to this kind of legislation. But that's right, Brian. The big winner this year, without any question in my mind, the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry, which just had a hit one home run after another here. Some reporters calling this session historic because of the reasons you just pointed out. It was so strong in the pro-business vein. They think this is an almost unprecedented kind of session for Republicans, for big business in Missouri.
Right to work was huge, and I agree with Steve in terms of the chamber getting a lot of successes, but there were a number of other anti-labor bills that did die. I mean, a lot of them died in the last day at that last hour because they were so focused on that St. Louis minimum wage. So labor did get some victories, but they also lost quite a bit. But that right to work thing, again, huge. The Democrats kind of seized stopping to fight it because they knew it was so early in January. They're hoping to overturn that next year in November on the ballot. Right?
Other big accomplishments of the year, Steve Kraske?
Well, I had several. I think
give us one.
One would be full funding of K-12 education. Republicans in the state Senate, against the wishes of leadership, Ryan Silvey of Kansas City, one of the ringleaders here, tossing in an extra $45 million into the kitty in the final days of the session. You know, for sure, the bar has been lowered in terms of what, quote, full funding of education means. Having said that, it's going to affect every school kid in Missouri. That's significant.
That is significant. As you said, what does full funding mean? There's always going to be questions about that. But it felt like a rare moment of bipartisan cooperation in an otherwise chaotic assembly.
Very good point. Yeah, absolutely. You know, Brian, I wanted to point to a couple of other things just quickly here. I think you could argue that passage of Real ID was really significant,
yeah,
only because if it hadn't have passed, and if Missourians were no longer able to use their driver's licenses to board airplanes, the chaos that would have ensued would have engulfed the entire General Assembly and cost lots of people political standing, I think, in a dramatic way.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Steve. That was the one I was going to mention, not because Real ID is the most important thing facing the state, perhaps, but because it was such an example of a popular issue, an issue that most people in Missouri, I think, were vaguely aware of this, aware that the legislature simply had to do something. They had to say yes to something, and this would solve a very obvious problem. And the real prospect that emerged in the last couple of weeks of the legislature not being able to do that, not being able to
Well, they want to be the first legislature that has taken up the issue and not been able to do anything if that had been the case.
That is true, but
they
would be
facing the deadline.
Exactly, and they would have been one of the last five states to actually come up with a solution. They are one of the last five states, but they did it. And that, you know, it may not have been a home run, but a solid grounder through the hole at shortstop was all they needed, and they got it. Let's move on to the unfinished business of this General Assembly session. What got started but never got finished this session? Brian Houseworth, let's start with you.
Well, the two biggest things, Brian, that stick out to me are prescription drug monitoring.
Let's remind our listeners, prescription drug monitoring program, 49 states have one, keeps track of what medicine has been prescribed. It's a database that doctors and pharmacies share. Missouri is the only one without one, and supporters say it'll help reduce opioid abuse. But it ran into objections. It has now for several years in a row, mostly from Senator Rob Schaff in the Senate, and couldn't get across the finish line. Maria Carter, unfinished business?
Well, I definitely agree about the prescription drug program. It seems, you know, at this point, Missouri being the last state. The other thing I'd add is the governor's kind of pledge there to get ethics reform passed.
Why do you think it died?
You know, I mean, I think there are so many things going on. And, you know, in part, there were a lot of ethics concerns raised. And I think that makes a conversation around that more difficult, you know, I mean, right. by people in the Senate who were
right.
in places of power and who might not have wanted
when
their business.
Ethics questions about the Senate leaders,
up.
About the House leaders, about the governor
yeah.
who would sign it. It makes yeah. it challenging
and,
to fight.
You know, and then, I mean, I think this isn't, I mean, this has been an ongoing issue in Missouri. And I think the people that need to pass this are the ones who probably benefit the most directly from not having it passed. And, you know, it makes it a hard thing to really get that coalition together when, you know, you can look at how this would directly affect you in your next campaign.
Yeah, I mean, and I would add to the not only did the lobbyist gift ban not pass, not only did the revolving door legislation regarding legislators who go on to be lobbyists that Governor Greitens wanted, that was dead on arrival. That was made pretty clear from the beginning. But also with the court a few weeks ago striking down portions of the law that limited campaign contributions, now you have reopened another aspect of the money in politics question, not so much ethics reform as campaign finance reform, that we thought we had resolved at least for a couple years in Missouri. That's back on the table, too. So get ready for more of the same, I think.
Well, even if the governor calls a special session and he says that ethics is going to be the focus, you really begin to wonder if the state Senate will go along with anything. They have been so adamant, so consistently now for several years to not go along with these kinds of changes that you wonder if even the focus, the intense focus of a special session would change any of that.
That's all the time we have. As always, we invite our guests to help us find the song that would appropriately end this roundup of the legislative session. And in keeping with custom, each of you will make a suggestion and I will pick the winner. Let's start with Maria Carter.
I am going with Welcome to the Jungle.
Interesting choice. Steve Kraske.
Don't Stop Believing by Journey.
Brian Houseworth.
We're not going to take it anymore.
We've got a pretty rocking group of songs here,
you
Brian.
You do. Those are excellent choices, but I think there is a clear winner, Brian Houseworth. We're not going to take it anymore. We will go out with that. Thank you all for being here.
You bet. The Who had a better version of that song than what I'm hearing right now. That was an excerpt of KCUR's podcast, State House Blend Missouri. To hear the full conversation, subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcast and on the NPR One app. On tomorrow's show, we discuss the new proposal that would turn KCI into a single terminal airport. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.